is issuing a vertically polarized wave. If it's a quarter wave antenna, it is using the ground plane radials as the counterpoise. That really means what do you push against. You've heard the example I've used a lot of times. When Arnold Schwarzenegger is floating in free space in the cargo hold of the space shuttle, assume he weighs 200 pounds and he's got a 200-pound barbell in his hand. And he pushes the barbell 1 meter per second to the north. And by action and reaction, he moves 1 meter per second to the south. He's pushing against, his body is the counterpoise and the barbell is the antenna, if you know what I mean. So what we call counterpoise is what the antenna pushes against. Or you can say it is the reservoir of electrons. On one half cycle, it's pumping electrons from the counterpoise into the antenna. On the other half cycle, it's pumping electrons from the antenna back into the counterpoise. You've got to push against something. So whether the thing you push against is above the antenna when it's upside down or below the antenna when it's right side up doesn't really matter. The counterpoise is still there. As long as you've got an antenna and a counterpoise and a source of signal and a transmission line, you've got radiation. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Welcome to KC4WGB. KC4 Wesley's gay boyfriend. Where is Wesley's boyfriend?
Yeah, I've learned also that the activity of the cockroach is usually from 11 o'clock for the 4 hours. But anyhow, coming back, thank you very much for that explanation, and we have a gentleman who has a question, and to Andrea.
And KC2, Wesley's gay boyfriend, KC2, Wesley's gay boyfriend, Wesley would like to suck your kibasa, where are you? KC2WGB, KC2, Wesley's gay boyfriend, is Wesley calling you for kibasa sucking?
For this guy.
KC2WGB, Wesley is looking to suck your kibasa.
KC2MMY, Mike Yankee, I think that's Raymond. Go ahead, Raymond, KQRIW, my name is Dick.
And then KC2WGB, looking to suck Wesley's kibasa. Wesley will suck anybody's kibasa. I'll be making the joke. Wesley's looking to suck big Polish kibasa. Anybody got Polish kibasa on frequency?
How you doing, KC2 Mike Yankee? Yeah, it's Ray. You got a good memory. I'm not on that often. I had a question back to running, let's say, the small diameter 30-gauge wire around the house. Let's say I run it around the roof of the house, you know, stealth. You know, what's the odds of lightning hitting something like that if I leave it up? I'm kind of scared to do it, but I need to do something like that for, like, 80 meters.
It's about one chance in a million. And I'm only slightly exaggerating when I say that, Ray. When you and I put up a piece of wire, a tower, an antenna, and whatever, it's on our mind. We see that piece of metal, and we think it's a real lightning attractor, and we lose a lot of sleep over that. And if you really study what lightning does, assume now you're a lightning bolt and you're looking down on Yonkers. I'm looking down on Convert Avenue in Yonkers. And what do I see? I see a whole bunch of metal. That's the structure inside of buildings. I see a tremendous amount of metal. That's all of the wiring for the Con Ed wiring. I see a great big monkey bars worth of wiring going up and down every one of those blocks. I see a huge number of targets. I see hills. I see buildings. I see water towers. I see power wiring. All of those things are lightning attractors. The chances of your piece of 30-gauge wire alongside of your house or on floor number 2 of your house, the chances of lightning finding that very object and hitting it is one chance in a million. Very, very slight. What's more likely, let me drop. What's more likely to happen is lightning is going to strike something a quarter mile away from you. The lightning bolt consists of 11,000 amperes.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Welcome to the wrestling, everybody else go fuck yourself.
striking a quarter mile away, a half mile away, and it's 11,000 amperes, makes a very strong magnetic field for the 20 microseconds that it flows. And by the way, what you call a lightning bolt, if you really took a high-speed photography of it, you'd see it's about 3, 4, 5 flashes. It's not really just one. They're very close together, and your eye may not catch them, but there's a whole bunch of flashes there. And that strong magnetic field gets picked up by all of the wiring in your neighborhood, the Con Ed wiring, your antenna, whatever. And that magnetic field picked up by your antenna makes a spike of voltage that flows down your transmission line. That's what happens 99% of the time. Electromagnetic coupling. Does the lightning strike your antenna exactly directly? Almost never. I've got 100 feet of tower on top of 300 feet of land. I'm the biggest target around. And I was living here for 20 solid years before I had one nearby lightning strike that created some damage of the electronics in my shack, in my house. It damaged the computer. It damaged the television set. It didn't damage any of my ham radio equipment. And I'm not a guy that disconnects all the cables. A lot of people do. So it hit a power line, most likely in my neighborhood, because a bunch of my neighbors also suffered a damage to their computers and television sets. So go ahead and put lightning arresters on there if it'll give you peace of mind. But it's one chance in a million that you're going to be struck. You're an extremely small target, as I see it, Ray. KC2, Mike Yankee, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, okay, one more question. How does the liability work? I mean, I have renters, you know, I rent the top floor, I have renter's insurance. I mean, if they see anything like that, you know, they consider, oh, this guy's running crazy stuff out the, you know, windows, he's going to be liable to the house if it goes on fire. I mean, this is all the stuff I think about, you know, so I don't know. You know, and I don't really have a really good grounding system. I'm kind of grounded to a radiator here, and, you know. But I don't, I'm careful. I shut everything off when I'm not using it and everything. So I don't know, you know.
Mike, does the house have gutters, KTYL?
Yeah, it's got some gutters, I thought, to hooking some stuff up to and using an antenna tuner. I went outside to check the grounding to the house itself to what do they use up here, Con Ed? I mean, that grounding rod's even broken, and I guess nobody cares about fixing it, you know, even the grounding rod to the house. But I heard you're not allowed to hook up to the grounding rod to the house. It has to be a separate grounding yard, grounding line per the fire department, and there's all kinds of codes and stuff. I don't know if I'm breaking them and what the liability is. So I have this fear of antenna for 80 meters, you know. Right now, I just use a piece of wire out the window. It kind of works okay for 20 meters, you know, but it don't have to be that long.
I'm just pointing out you have metal gutters, and they haven't been hit by lightning yet, so I doubt your 30-gauge wire is going to be that much bigger mass compared to that pretty large-sized gutter on the house. K2YL.
Okay, so I believe that it's pretty safe. I was just curious if anybody had any insight as to liability and what the code is for, you know, if they catch and it's not exactly right, or, you know, what you can get away with.
Yeah, John recognized the chances of you creating any substantial amount of damage with a piece of 30-gauge wire connected to a transmitter is extremely slim. The biggest variable, as I see it, Ray, is How good is your relationship between you and the supervisor of your building, and how good is the relationship of you and your neighbors? If your neighbors know that you're a ham radio operator and you're a fairly friendly guy and you're not crazy and you're not wild-eyed and there aren't horns coming out of your head and you're not trying to kill their television set, so to speak, with television interference, as long as you've got a fairly good relationship with your neighbors and your supervisor.
Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
So as I see it, the biggest variable is how friendly you are with the people around you. I know of a guy who once told his neighbors, the FCC has given me this permission to do this transmitting, and even though I'm making all kinds of interference for you, you can't do anything about it. You're wasting your time. He said things like that to his neighbors. He created a range war, and his life was miserable for the next 5 years. You don't want to do that. You live in the pocket of your neighbors, if you know what I mean, and so stay friendly with them. and do a little bit of explanation of what you're doing and why it's the right thing to do and why it's so educational. John, KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, I think maybe you should remind the hams that using a radiator is not a good idea for ground. They're not well grounded.
Well, it's a substantial chunk of metal that goes all over in the building, and how well that's grounded is a function of your particular installation. There are installations where it is well grounded, where the water pipes and radiators all come together at a couple of common points, and then many buildings, mine is one of them, the water pipe system that goes out to the street, the 3/4 inch diameter pipe, I think it is the main grounding for my house, which was built in the late 50s. I think more modern houses are not built that way. So in some cases, it could be a pretty good ground. Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, but remember, the radiators, all those radiators go back to the boiler, and they all have a dope on the pipes. Sometimes there's plastic fittings in the boiler, especially the new ones. That doesn't mean the radiators are grounded, even though they're in common pipe chases.
Even though there was pipe dope and or wrapping of Teflon tape on those threads, when those threads are really tightly meshed together, you put your ohmmeter between them, and I'll bet you 99% of the time, real electrical contact is being made through all that material. The metal has to touch somewhere, with rare exception. So, if you've got a whole lot of PVC pipe in your house, that's going to be a pretty poor ground. But those are only fairly modern installations. The older buildings in Yonkers, I'll bet you there's all kinds of ways that you can put an ohmmeter between a known good ground rod and your radiator, and you could confirm how well it's grounded. What do you think about that, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Oh, you're exactly right, Dick. In fact, that's what we used to do. The New York City Code, you're required to have 25 ohms or less, say, on the ground in each system. And if you measure the radiators, you'll find some of them at 300 ohms, 400 ohms. We did the test many times. So, just a word.
KC2MMY, just to let you know, I do have a good relationship with everybody. I tell people as little as I can, and, I just want to be really careful. What else was I going to say? I totally forgot what I was thinking about. Sorry.
I don't think you've got a problem, Ray. You may be worrying unnecessarily. And before some great big state or federal agency is going to come down on you, they're going to give you all kinds of warning that we found the structure and it's not meeting the code and you've got to change it in this manner. You get a whole lot of warning. You're not out to burn the house down and to irradiate people and to give them cancer and whatever. There's always a couple of people who believe that every radio signal is capable of doing damage, and they're super conservative. I mean, we've got something like 400 million, is it, or 300 million cell phones being used in the United States right now. There are a few people who believe that every one of those cell phones are creating cellular damage to those users. There are a few people who believe that. The chances of that being accurate are very, very slim. Here we are 20 years downrange, and millions of cell phones in this country, as well as a whole lot of other countries. There's probably something like 2 billion cell phones in use in the world right now. Can you imagine what would happen if somebody could prove that they're really creating a radio frequency biohazard? Wow. And even if you could prove it, the next question somebody would ask is, okay, it's bad. How bad is it? I'm in love with my cell phone. I don't want to give it up. If someone could prove to me that my cell phone is lowering my IQ by 1 point, would I give it up? I doubt it. Over to you, Ray. KC2MMY, K2RIW.
K2LIW, this is KC2MMY for ID, and yeah, what was I going to say? I got a little RFI, I just, you know, I try to get a couple words in, a little RFI here. If I turn up the wattage too much, I hear myself coming through my computer speakers. So I'm trying to eliminate that. I put all kind of chokes on, and I've actually moved the position of the wire outside the house seems to help a lot. So I don't know how much I'm affecting the neighbors. I usually try to use HF when they're not around. You know, but it's almost like, you know, you're scared to use it because you don't want to bother anybody, you know. So these are the problems I have. But, you know, just maybe I need to talk with more people and, you know, any comments would be welcome. And that's pretty much it. And thanks for the chat. And I've been listening all night, so. And I listen all the time, too. K2MM1.
Very fine, Ray. Next week we're going to give you a pop quiz to see how well you listen. I'm having fun with you. Many of these speaker systems for a computer are inside of a plastic box with very poor shielding. All of the wiring to them, the 110-volt wiring, the wall wart, and the wiring into the computer, it's all exposed, acting as an antenna. And so the fact that your speakers pick up the signal, rectify it, and send it out to loudspeakers through the amplifier of the speakers, that's not unusual. And with a little bit of testing, you can find out how it's getting in and how to stop it from doing that. So if you wanted to, you could eliminate that. And even if you find out that the neighbors are getting a similar problem, there's ways of fixing it for the neighbor, depending on how friendly you are with them. That's getting into a delicate area now as to how much repair or improvement you'll do. There are a couple of hams I know where a particular very inexpensive cordless phone of the neighbor was being interfered with. And to repair that phone was so difficult that what the ham did, I'm not recommending this, but what the ham did is went out and bought them a better brand of cordless phone that didn't have the RF pickup problem and handed it to them free of charge. In many cases, that's the simplest way to solve a problem. Make it go away. And they can't be unhappy that you gave them free of charge something that no longer has the problem. It is proof positive that it wasn't caused by you. It was caused by the brand X telephone. Over to you, Ray, K2RIW.
Well, their biggest claim, and I mean they work with me, and I try not to use it when they're home, is that they hear me on their TV, and I'm afraid to blow up their $700 LCD screen TV. In fact, I make sure mine is off when I'm using the radio, so that's my next biggest concern. And the thing is, their TV and the radio, I'm right above their TV. I mean, they're right exactly below me, so you know, it is a close distance, you know. But I mean, if the TV works on what? Well, it used to be 50 megahertz. They're using all kinds of stuff now. You know, try not to be close to those frequencies. But I think it's just so overpowering. If you use 100 watts or even 60 watts, it just goes into their TV. You know. But like I said, I put the chokes on. I don't know if they're effective.
Is there a way that you can arrange your antenna to be further away from that neighbor's TV set? Over to you, Ray.
KC2LIW, KC2MMY, yes, I did that, and I think it did solve the problem. I just actually moved the TV, the wire, the end of the radiation wire, away from the wall, you know, further out. I went under the, what do you call it, the evings of the house. You can actually go 2 or 3 feet out, forward towards the street, so the end of the wire doesn't lay on the house, and a lot of RFI went away.
Yeah, some people call that the overhang or the soffit. So the fact that the overhang was like 3 feet out, and you put the wire out there, there's various ways you can position the wire such that it's further from the set. Inverse square law, every time you double the distance between your antenna and their piece of equipment, every time you double the distance, they will get one quarter the amount of signal that they used to get. So distance is a very good way. That's a lot easier than trying to put bypassing devices on their expensive television set. Many people are rather reluctant to let you come in and add things to their television set for fear that you're going to interfere with its performance. You've got to worry about the fact that you may put a simple ferrite choke around the 110-volt cord that feeds power to their TV set. And if one week downrange, the TV set does something they don't like, you're likely to get blamed. You've got to worry about that. Good luck with that project, Ray, and let us know how it goes. N2XJN, K2RIW, Red Wesley.
Thank you very much. I have a question. The last time, of course, the question was the permission of the cockroach. When we spoke about a wire in the tube, and the tube has is not connected anywhere, it's flowing in the air, and there should be very minimum impact on the radiating pattern of the antenna. But let's say when we connect the inner wire from the concentric cable, 6 feet long, to RF, then you connect the end of that inner wire into the shield, then for a given wavelength, you have the impedance and gain control circuit. Yes or no?
Yeah, I'm looking at the May issue of QST in the technical topics section. They had something that's very close to what you're talking about. I'm looking for the right page right now, and when I find it, it'll help a little bit on what we're talking about. Why in the world can't I find that right now? Ah, there it is. It's on page 52. Technical correspondence, May issue QST magazine. What the guy is doing is he's building a sampling device which samples the amount of RF energy flowing down his coax cable. And he has built a transformer. And the transformer has a primary winding and a secondary winding. The primary winding is a piece of coaxial cable where he is feeding the signal through the center conductor of the coaxial cable. And the shield of the coaxial cable is grounded at one side of the primary winding of the transformer and not grounded on the second side. So the signal itself is flowing down the center conductor of a coax cable, and one end of that coax cable is grounded. And yet the magnetic field from that coax cable gets into that transformer and goes to the secondary and gets measured. Very interesting article. It's on the subject you were discussing last week and now this week. And so the way a signal gets out of a shielded structure and gets radiated, a magnetic field, is a little bit more complicated than first meets the eye. Maybe you haven't gotten your May issue yet, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Yeah, I believe that example is a little bit slightly different from the one that I described. You have a coaxial cable, and the inner wire is connected to the transmitter. Now, at the end, all the way to the top of the center conductor is connected to the shield. Back to you.
The center conductor is connected to the shield at the top.
And the shield is loading.
The center conductor is connected to the shield at the top, and the center conductor is connected to the transmitter at the bottom, and the shield is connected to the transmitter at the bottom. Is that correct?
No. The shield is not connected anywhere. The shield is floating. The center conductor is connected only at the bottom to the transmitter, but on the top is connected to the shield. But the shield is floating from the bottom.
Okay, you're going to have to explain that a little bit more. The coaxial cable is connected to the output connector of the transmitter, which means the shield is grounded at the case of the transmitter, and the center conductor is being fed by the transmitter.
No. The inner wire is connected, like in the ground plane, is connected only to the transmitter. Now, the shield is floating. is not connected anywhere at the bottom, but the shield all the way at the top is connected to the center conductor.
A conductor to the shield, don't you know? Just shut up and let Wesley talk all the time. To Wesley, that you must shut up.
If I understand correctly, you said the center conductor coming out of the transmitter goes to the center conductor of the cable, but the shield is not connected there. And the center conductor is connected to the shield of the coax cable at the other end of the cable, at the antenna end.
Right.
I'm a little curious as to why you would want to do it that way, Wesley.
He's a fucking idiot!
Life of the cockroach. The reason for that is because I want to find out whether I would have a gain and impedance control, and how would then this kind of reverse L shape antenna radiate. Back to you.
So is your motivation to try to use the shield of the transmission line as the antenna? Is that what your motivation is?
No, the motivation is that when I connect the center conductor all the way at the top to the shield, to the braid, then I'm increasing the capacitive coupling of the center of the braid towards the center conductor. Therefore, I'm creating the resonant circuit. Back to you.
Polak is a fucking idiot, that's for sure.
The length of the transmission line in what you describe is a kind of resonant circuit. And it's a sort of a re-entrant cavity. The center conductor, grounded at the far end, is the quarter wave ground, and if the cable itself is a quarter wave long, that is a kind of resonator. Is there antenna at the shorted end, or just the cable itself is intended to be the antenna? Now back to you, Wesley.
So practically, when you connect all the way to the top, the end of the center conductor to the shield, you're creating half wavelength antenna. Additional capacitive coupling.
How long is the coax cable?
I say the coax cable is 6 meters, and you create a quarter of wavelength of the center conductor as a whip of the ground plane, let's say. Now, you connect the braid to the center conductor all the way to the top. Now you have exactly another 6 feet, let's say, or 6 meters of wavelength, whatever you take. Now, the antenna becomes halfway antenna.
Yeah, where the shield is floating right at the transmitter connection is a very unusual way of doing things. So it's a quarter wavelength of transmission line, shorted at the far end, and the shield is not connected at the transmitter end.
That's not what he's saying, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Geez, boyfriend sticking up for...
Look at it this way, Dick. If we had a regular mag mount on a car, and it's connected to the transmitter in a normal fashion, now we just unscrew the antenna itself, and now he wants to screw in a piece of coax that is not connected to at the connection end. What he wants to do is go up the center conductor, bend it over, and solder it to the braid, and at the other end of that braid is not connected to the mount. That's what he's talking about.
The fuck knows what Wesley is talking about?
And John, the motivation for doing that is you used to have a quarter wave radiator,
and now you have a half wave length.
Blah, 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 blah.
With Dick things.
Yep, all right. quiet and listen to Wesley's stupid fucking questions.
Now, mechanically, it's still a quarter wave long. Am I correct on that one, John?
Yes, the center conductor is a quarter wave length long. Then it's folded over, and we have a quarter wave length of shield connected to it, which is not grounded to the mount.
And you're calling that a half-wave antenna. Do you believe, because it's electronically a half-wave, mechanically a quarter-wave, that it's going to have a different radiation pattern? Is that part of the motivation, John?
I don't know what the motivation is, but I've discussed this with him. I'm only saying that now it was, say, 20 inches long. Effectively now, when we bend it over and solder to it, now it returns down another 20 inches, so it's actually 40 inches long, or whatever wavelength it is.
And also, we discussed it with Glenn, we discussed that with Eric, and the impressions I have got that I have a half wave, now instead of quarter wavelength, half wavelength antenna.
You're fucking stupid.
If, as a temporary experiment, you grounded the shield at the bottom and fed the center conductor in the way you're talking about, it'd be feeding the coax cable in a normal manner. The end of the cable sees a short circuit. A quarter wavelength away from a short circuit, you see an open circuit. So if the shield was grounded in the bottom in the normal manner, you would be looking into a perfect open circuit. If the coax cable was lossless, you'd see an infinite impedance. Now, when you unground the shield of what was an infinite impedance, my first guess is that very little is going to happen. But I don't believe it. And I don't think this is an easy thing to model.
Well, you have a twice wavelength. One is going up, one is going down. You have reverse L shape or U shape. Reverse U-shape antenna.
The fucking questions!
Yeah, if the bottom shield was grounded, do you agree that you would see, at the drive point at the bottom, you would see a nearly infinite impedance? Do I have an agreement on that one? If the impedance is infinity when it's grounded, will the infinity change when you unground it? The answer might be no. It would be an interesting experiment to run. I'm not convinced that most of the modeling programs can handle this one. I think we got to make a real test.
Look at it a different way, Dick.
Go ahead and try it.
Okay, let's say we took a piece of twin lead and replaced that as the antenna, connected one lead to the mount normally. We go up the twin lead, we short it at the top, and just leave the bottom hanging. What do we have now?
But this was why I was really pushing last TechNet on that, how the center conductor the couples with the braid in terms of the inductive coupling and the capacitive coupling, because there must be difference between the twin lead and the difference between the coaxial cable. As the coaxial cable has a braid around the center conductor.
Except for the fact that the twin lead usually has a higher impedance than coax, they might be very close to the same performance. Until we really do the experiment, we won't know. That's not an easy one. I think I made some pronouncements on this one last week, and I'm not so confident right now.
How would we go about modeling an experiment for that, Dick? Build it and do what?
Take a known quarter wave ground plane antenna. Measure its standing wave ratio. Measure its phase center of standing wave ratio on a slotted line. On the slotted line, you'll find out where the first null is. And you'll find out what the peak to valley is. You'll find out the standing wave ratio. You'll know the phase angle of the reflection. You'll know whether or not the antenna is a little bit capacitive, a little bit inductive. You'll know whether or not it's a a 70-ohm antenna or a 30-ohm antenna. The slotted line, properly used, will tell you all of that. Then replace that quarter wave radiator with either this piece of coax or with a piece of twin lead and make the measurement again. That's going to give you a lot of information. Do you see that process, John?
Yes, I do, Dick. That makes a lot of sense. Just didn't know what actually to look for, but that's right. With a slotted line, we should be able to do all of that. So there you go, Wes. You got use for that slotted line that's coming.
Well, I didn't get it yet, but when I'm going to get the packet, I'm going to deliver it to you. And we can both do the experiment, or you can do the experiment by yourself. Question for you, Dick. If we have a quarter wavelength ground plane, and then we don't bend anything, we just exchange the whip with half wavelength, would I be then in need to adjust the length of the counterpoise?
Not at all. When you make the radiator half wave, you can almost throw away the counterpoise entirely. You feed the outer end of a half wavelength radiator, those Brown and Woodward curves that are, the resistive curve and the reactive curve, that's on the amateurradio.tv website under K2RIW YAGI information. It'll tell you exactly what impedance you're going to get, and it's going to be something like 1,500 ohms. When it was a quarter wave long, you were feeding 35 ohms of resistance. When you make it a half wave long, you're feeding 1,500 ohms. The ground plane almost doesn't matter anymore. You're feeding such a high impedance. Without re-impedance matching, you'll have an extremely high standing wave ratio. But feeding the outer end of a half wavelength, once you do the right impedance matching, is a very intelligent thing to do. It's a very high performance antenna. But because the impedance is unusual, 1,500 ohms, people are afraid to use it. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
Yeah, I wonder if the cockroach has a short period of time of inactivity in his nightlife. Anyhow, I understand, but should I also understand that I have to use the magic transformer, the thyroid balloon?
How about we stay up all night answering stupid fucking questions from Wesley? That would be much fun, no?
In order to step up the impedance, the way they normally do it with half-wave and 5/8 wave mag mount antennas is there is a loading coil at the bottom. The bottom of the loading coil is grounded to the magnet. The center conductor, the input transmission line, is also grounded to the magnet. The shield is. And the center conductor is tapped up something like one turn on that coil. And the top of the coil has 1,500 ohms, and it feeds the end of the half-wave radiator. So making a step-up transformer, and there's many ways of doing it, a J-pole does something like that. A J-pole antenna is an impedance step-up device. The loading coil they got in the bottom of a 5/8 wave mag mount, that's one of these things. So it doesn't take very much hardware to do that step-up. And no, you don't need ferrite. When you're feeding 1,500 ohms, you don't have to worry about balancing devices. There's so little current flowing there, there's not much current left over to flow down the outside of the shield of the transmission line. Over to you, Wesley, K2RIW.
And to XGN. Okay, thank you very much for that explanation. I'm still having a problem with the center conductor of the coaxial cable connected on the top to the braid. If the braid is surrounding the central conductor, that it looks like all of the radiation from the center conductor goes to the braid, and because the braid is floating in the air from the bottom, then this braid is re-radiating the energy from the center conductor plus the quarter wavelength energy that he's got from the top of the antenna. Is that correct? Back to you.
There, I'm not sure. We're going to have to do that experiment. But I think when you do it with coax cable or with twin lead, you're going to get a fairly similar result. Even though that's not good common sense, and I know I gave an answer that was different than that last week. I'm not sure. We're going to have to do an experiment on this one. I'm not going to get a chance to do it this week, but I might get a chance to build one of these at a UHF frequency and see what happens. Impedance matching is going to be a little bit of a chore. Although I don't have to impedance match it. If I've got a good network analyzer, I just measure what it was before and what it was after when you change the radiator. In the case of twin lead, you're just folding back the radiator and back onto itself. It's like half of a folded dipole, 300 ohm folded dipole, but it's only half of one. And how is that going to behave?
G2 QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Actually, I had my analyzer on here, and I have a piece of coax, and I've been doing this while I've been listening here in the background. And what happens, what I've seen is that when I took a piece of random length of coax, it was a little bit more than a foot long, and I just connected up the, you know, open on both sides, and just connected up the center conductor to the analyzer, and it had a resonance somewhere like in the, you know, 420 megahertz area. And what was interesting was that then I shorted the top, and the impedance goes up a little bit, but certainly nowhere near halfway of Dick. KTYIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, when it comes to today's predictions, I was predicting that when you short it at the top, not much happens at the resonant frequency. Is that approximately what you saw, Glenn?
Yeah, it actually looked like it killed some of the Q of it, and it looks like the impedance went up a little bit, too.
But if I measured the impedance at the resonant frequency before you shorted it, and then you shorted it, at the resonant frequency, was the change only a few percent?
Yeah, that's what it appeared to be. If anything, it looked like the frequency dropped a little bit and the impedance went up, but not by a whole heck of a lot.
Yeah, what I was predicting is that when you've got a short circuit of a quarter wavelength of transmission line at the far end, and you're feeding it in a normal manner, you're going to see a nearly perfect open circuit. And when I remove the shield at the bottom, and I previously had an open circuit, I've now got a circuit that's doubly open. As such, I'm predicting today not much happens at the resonant frequency. Off of resonance, all hell breaks loose. But at resonant frequency, I think very little happens. If you already had an open circuit and you remove the shield, you just have a second open circuit. You see what I'm saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Except the only difference in my experiment over here is that if I lift it up the way that you're seeing it, I see almost high impedance. There's no resonance there whatsoever. I have to basically tie the, like I have a little plate here, and I have to take the end of that, in other words, where the analyzer is, I have to ground one side of the analyzer and then ground the plate back to the analyzer. If I don't, then there's no resonance at all. So in other words, the ground has to be on the analyzer and the plate in order for this to work, if you follow what I'm saying.
I think I do. And I think it's time to put a couple of pictures of this into the Limoc log. You've got an interesting experiment there, Glenn.
I don't know how interesting it is, but it is a little off-center. But, yeah, I guess basically what's happening is, you know, we're trying to use a piece of coax as a whip antenna here. But certainly if you short the top, it doesn't really... it's definitely not a half-wave antenna after that, that's for sure.
My question was related not really to the antenna. I'm dragging the subject of the antenna. What I want you to know is if I have one coil next to the other, and then I have one coil inside the other, and let's say the coil represents... The outer winding of the coil represents a solid copper pipe. That's the winding. And then I have a center small the copper rod in it. Would that be a difference between these two structures, two coils, one next to the other, and the two coils being set concentrically? Back to you.
Well, Wesley, in order for a transformer to work or to have good coupling, you have to have a right-hand plane with the magnetic fields. In other words, if you're going to wind a transformer and you have a coil, you've got to put the other coil on the same magnetic path length so that that you're going to have coupling. If you've got a tube of copper in a linear direction and you put something in the middle, the directions of magnetic lines of flux are not aligned. So you can see what I'm saying, that you're going to have you've got to create some kind of a circuit outside or around that pipe in order to create that circuit that you're looking for. KC2QIQ.
Glenn, hold on a minute. You got a problem. Do you have the May issue of QST in your hands yet?
Not handy, Dick.
Can you get it?
I'm not sure where it is right now, but maybe you can bring up the counterpoints on this one.
Until yesterday when I got my May issue, I would have agreed with you. When you get a chance, go to page 52. At the bottom of the page, you're going to see a transformer. That's two coils side by side that Wesley's talking about. Primary and secondary winding. The primary winding is a piece of coax cable, and the signal is being fed through the sender conductor of the coax cable. The coax cable is the primary winding, and one side of the shield of that coax cable is grounded. And therefore, how does the magnetic field on the sender conductor, and it's only on the sender conductor, how is the magnetic field getting out of that shield, which is grounded at one end, and getting as and acting as the primary winding of that transformer, and this beautiful signal appearing on that secondary winding, and it's exactly the right amount of secondary winding signal, as if the primary winding...
Quarter wavelength thick?
Negatory. It is about a thousandth of a wavelength long. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, it's kind of a mystery. I have to take a look at that one. Because I know, like, when I'm designing, you know, like, 4-to-1 transformers and things like that with coax, that basically if I make them quarter wavelength long, and then I connect, you know, center lead to the outer shield, I can create that impedance transformation. But I'd have to see what this model is first before I can understand it, because right now I guess I'm not following. I'll have to take a peek at it.
Okay, I'll give you a couple articles, a couple of pointers as to what the antenna is. Technical Correspondence, page 52, May issue, 2011. The guy is trying to generate a 40 dB directional coupler. Not directional, 40 dB coupler. He wants to be able to test a kilowatt or 1500 watt transmitter. If it was a kilowatt transmitter and he's got a 40 decibel coupler, that means plus 20 dBm appears at his measurement port. He did that by having a piece of coax cable going right through the center of a box. And around that piece of coax cable, it's a piece of semi-rigid cable, around the piece of coax cable, he put a toroid. So the coax cable going through the center constitutes one turn. And he wound 15 turns around the toroid as a secondary winding. And it's picking up exactly the right amount of voltage. Even though the primary winding is the piece of coax cable, grounded at one end and ungrounded at the other end, and only the signal is on the center conductor flowing through the box. The signal flows through the box into another object outside the box, which is a kilowatt dummy load. So as the signal flows through the piece of semi-rigid cable, which is the primary winding, and it's thoroughly shielded, that secondary winding on the toroid picks up exactly the right amount of signal. That's very opposite of what you and I would have predicted last week.
Yeah, but isn't the, on that coaxial cable, he's only got one side of the coaxial cable grounded, is that correct, and then runs the signal through the other side?
You got it. He grounded the coax cable, and the coax cable is there because he wanted no electrostatic coupling of the signal into the toroid, and he succeeded. There is no
signal on the outside of that shield of the semi-rigid cable. Over to you, Glenn.
So, but he does have the 50-ohm system working through the cable. In other words, right now, in other words, he's got a load on one side and a transmitter on the other side. So it is still working like a transmission line.
It's a transmission line that has an open circuit at one end. Well, the two connectors are on a box which is thoroughly closed. So the box is closed, but the semi-rigid cable flowing through the center of the box connects center conductor of input connector and center conductor of output connector, goes to the center conductor of the semi-rigid cable flowing through the middle of the box. The center conductor, the semi-rigid cable shield is grounded at one side. And near that grounded side, a toroid is sitting on the outside of that semi-rigid cable. The semi-rigid cable is there to stop electrostatic coupling, and he succeeded. Only the magnetic coupling is getting into the toroid. Therefore, the magnetic field, in this example, appears to be getting through the shield of the semi-rigid cable. And the semi-rigid cable looks to me like it's about a half an inch long, and he's using it at 7 megacycles, for instance. That's a very short number of wavelengths. How about you, Glenn?
Before you answer, isn't it the same problem that I have had with the capacitor closed with the sort of Faraday cage, and I had the winding outside, and I was able to read from the capacitor the perfect signal that I had generated in outside to outside winding, and I was wondering why in the world it is possible.
Well, I can answer that one. I mean, you can have bad coupling. You know, when we're talking about transformer efficiency, we're talking about coupling of 1-to-1. I mean, if we're talking about like 20 dB down or greater, yeah, you can have poor coupling. And basically what's happened is he's created a situation where there is, you know, some leakage in a near field that's being captured around the area cross-section of a toroid. So I would imagine, yeah, there's some light leakage in a near field. And then if you close the field with the toroid, you have to be able to pick something off there, but it's going to be quite a few dB down. Dick, does it say in the article how many dB down it is? Because that'll probably tell you what the insulation characteristic is of that piece of semi-rigid cable, KC2, QIQ.
The article is a well-calibrated 40 dB directional coupler. The 40 dB is coming from the 15-to-1 turns ratio. He's got 15 turns on the secondary. Then he has a resistor divider network after the 15 turns, and he gets exactly the calculated voltage he's supposed to get. The coupling coefficient between that primary winding, which is shielded, and the toroid was 1-to-1. No extra loss. He got exactly the right amount of signal proportional to the number of turns in the primary and the number of turns in the secondary. Every bit of that magnetic field flowing down that center conductor of that semi-rigid cable went into that toroid, every bit of it. That's a mind blower. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, because in order for that to work, what that's really saying is that you would expect that the signal running down the coax is in common mode. Right? In other words, the voltage and the current running through the center of the coax should be the same as what's coming down the shield on the outside, but maybe that's not true of coax.
I know it would stop working if he grounded the other end of the shield. The fact that the shield is open on one end.
See, it's open. Open to what?
To nothing. The input connector, center conductor goes to semi-rigid.
Side or load side?
Let me finish. On the input coaxial connector of the box, center conductor of the connector, input connector, goes to the center conductor of the semi-rigid. Shield of the input connector goes to the shield of the semi-rigid. On the output end connector of the box, center conductor of semi-rigid goes to output end. The shield of the semi-rigid comes right up to that connector, but is not connected. Now,
Now, on the outside of that semi-rigid shield is a toroid. The shield and semi-rigid cable going through the center conductor, through the center hole of the toroid, is considered one turn. On the toroid are 15 turns as the secondary. He's picking up exactly the right amount of voltage on that secondary, 15 times greater than what's flowing down the primary. He then goes into a resistor divider network and gets exactly the right voltage. That coupling coefficient in the primary appears to be 1:1. That's a mind blower.
15 turns up. Is it just basic wire or is it another piece of coax? What is it?
The 15 turns up is ordinary enameled wire wound on the toroid. Go ahead.
Okay, so the feed line going through is terminated on both sides. In other words, one side is a transmitter, one side is a load. And RF is running through that cable, and I imagine that that semi-rigid cable is running through the center of the toroid. Is that correct?
You've got it. And the shield of the semi-rigid going through the toroid is grounded to the box, grounded to the input connector on one end only. The other end, the shield of the semi-rigid comes right up to the output connector, but the shield is not connected. Over to you, Glenn.
You say the shield is not connected. Not connected to what? In other words, there's got to be a load on one side and a transmitter on the other. In order for it to be a transmission line, the center and the shield have to be connected on both ends.
Don't forget this is a metal box. By way of the metal box, the shield of the input connector happens to be an SO239.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. Now I understand. So he's using the outside shield for the output connector as the metal box.
You've got it. But now, explain to me how the magnetic field flowing through the center conductor of that semi-rigid cable, how the heck is that getting into that toroid as the primary winding with 1:1 coupling coefficient?
Yeah, because now that piece of coax is no longer a balanced piece of coax. In other words, because the currents are flowing through the case, not through the shield of the coax. So the current that's running, that it's measuring, is the current through the center of that semi-rigid cable. QSL, KC2, QIQ.
I hear what you're saying. But he has confirmed that there is 0 volts on the output, on the outside shield of the semi-rigid. He did that in order to have no electrostatic coupling into the toroid and into the secondary winding. And the semi-rigid cable, grounded at one end, is providing the electrostatic shield. With reference to the box, there is no voltage apparent on that shield of the semi-rigid cable. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense to me, Dick. As far as I'm concerned, he could take that piece of semi-rigid coax out and just put a single piece of wire through there, and he would have had the same exact result.
Same result, almost, except now he would have electrostatic coupling, and he would have an error voltage on that secondary winding.
Right on. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the only current that's flowing through that wire is through the center cable. The outside shield is just a floating like a... like you said, an electrostatic shield. It's not connected on the other side, so that coax really isn't working as a coax, as a true transmission line anymore.
Now, the toroid transformer is picking up a magnetic field. The magnetic field only exists inside of the semi-rigid cable. How's that magnetic field getting out of there?
Well, because the lines of flux through the center of the toroid are basically a right angle to the cross-sectional area of that ferrite material. So the current is running, regardless of whether there's a shield, a metal shield around the outside, that magnetic, the electrical field is running right through the center. And as far as the wound coil on the secondary side, it has 15 turns running through the center. So that extra piece of wire is like an open piece of wire. It's like almost like having a additional winding in a transformer that's not connected to anything. QSL, KC2, QIQ.
When a kilowatt of energy is flowing down a 50-ohm cable, it's something like 4.4 amperes flowing on the center conductor. That 4.4 amperes makes a certain amount of magnetic field. In this example, essentially all of that magnetic field is on the inside of a piece of semi-rigid cable. How's that magnetic field getting out of there to get into the toroid?
It would be the same thing as having two pieces of wire. Think of it as having two pieces of wire. If you had two pieces of wire on the primary, where one side is connected to the ground of the case and the other one is a throughput that's running through the connector on the other side. The current runs through the one winding through the center of the toroid. The other one is just a floating piece of wire.